tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Alright, and welcome to episode 35 of the InTech We Trust podcast. And this week I have with me the Wreckatron.
Hey Hans, how you doing, man?
And third guest, or host, better said, is Gabriel.
Hey guys, how's it going?
So it's the three of us today. Wreckatron, how was your week coming home after...
A whole bunch of stuff. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to be home because you can hear it right there. I'm drinking summer shandy. I'm happy to get my seasonal beer. It's basically a Belgian wheat beer style beer with lemonade injected in it. Really good summer sipper here in the States. Hey, man, it's good. Don't knock it till you try it.
When you said Belgian style wheat beer, I was okay. And then you said we inject lemonade. The horror.
No, dude, love it. Love it. It's good stuff. But honestly, no, I'm good to be home. In fact, when we talked last week, I wasn't really planning to be on, but I did jump on due to the situation. But basically, I actually was right then leaving Microsoft Ignite, and I just got back home last night from Atlanta because Thursday and Friday I was in Las Vegas. Man, it's been a journey, but good to be home right now.
You were preparing the VeeamON conference, right?
Yes, I was.
Oh, man. Oh, I still need to find a reason or a way to get there.
Hey, man,
so
don't
many
worry.
Friends there. Hey, and we've got Mr. Noise in the background. Hi, Gabriel.
Hey, how's it going, guys? I should somewhat relatively noise-free today, given that I'm actually at my home, and I'm down in my little cave. So, barring crazy children or dogs or something out of the ordinary, that should be my background noise today.
So you're not locked in a basement in Boulder, Colorado, where Aaron Delp is filling you with information?
No, actually. I was in Colorado all last week, getting kind of my ramp up and my, you know, drinking from the fire hose and all of the things you do when you join a company new again, and kind of getting to know who's who and getting part of the Boulder culture. Boulder is beautiful. I've only been there once before, and it snowed while I was there, and just as I was leaving, it started to snow again. So apparently I am the bringer of snow to Boulder, Colorado.
Well, it is surrounded by mountains.
It is. I'll tell you one thing, though. For a boy who lives at sea level, that extra few thousand feet, that mile high up in the air, really does play havoc on you when you first start to adjust. Running upstairs and things like that really was – I was winded at the end. I'm like, this is so bizarre and abnormal for me. But apparently you get used to it.
Did you get high altitude sickness? That's actually a really common thing.
It is really – common thing there, and the key is to drink water, apparently. And so I just pounded water the whole time I was there, and I really didn't get sick or anything of that nature, but, you know, it did mess with my sleep pattern. And I'm, you know, it could just be the normal I'm traveling and living in a hotel for a week sleep interruption, but just didn't seem like I could ever get quite the right proper amount of rest. Thankfully I can live on very little.
That's really crazy, because I did a lot of work in the Mexican state of San Luis Potosi in a large part of last decade. And San Luis Potosi, the city I was at, was literally around 3,000 meters elevation, about 9,500 feet elevation. You get off the plane there and boom, you had like a cold right away, bloody nose and all that. It always took me a day to adjust to it. And you're right about that air. Those high altitude cities, it is really a big difference. So glad to see you made it out okay.
Okay, so last week, a lot of conventions. This week, another bunch of conventions. We have IBM Edge Cloud Foundry Summit and Citrix Synergy going on at the same time. Haven't heard that much news except for there's maybe one or two parts in our tech news of this week rounding Citrix. Haven't heard anything actually coming out of IBM Edge. There's a lot of discussions going around on Cloud Foundry Summit. Haven't really heard news about it, but we do have one or two things to say about Citrix Synergy. On last week's show, so we every week we tend to look a little bit back on last week's show. We had the one of the things we talked about was the removal of Patch Tuesday at Microsoft. And Chris Evans, one of our listeners and good friend in the community, took it to our LinkedIn group for a good discussion, where he said, "You know what, guys? Please do not think that we're going to a full-time updates like you do on your phones in the data center." And he has a really good point. So it wasn't my intention to say that we should do that on a server level, of course. But the fact that Microsoft is releasing the updates as they come out instead of once a month, for me, was a big deal. In that you can change your plan. At least you can choose how to plan it instead of getting the whole bunch shoved down your throat.
I would say, as somebody who, you know, I remember getting on, we had the Patch Tuesday call when Shavlik used to give it, right? And you would sit around and you would listen to all the vulnerabilities and kind of get the backstory on what they were trying to fix. I kind of like the idea of a dedicated time frame that you can schedule around versus something that just trickles out ad nauseum, because that way you can start to evaluate and plan around it much more so than you can, well, hey, this patch is dropping today. Because most organizations, you know, at least been my experience, that, you know, you wanted to run through, we would run it through it in three phases where, you know, dev, test, QA, and then production. And we would roll those patches out accordingly and verify. So I don't know how much companies or organizations have to change their traditional patching mechanisms to accommodate a more as needed.
Well, that's the whole deal, right? You won't really have to change. So you can still stick to your guns at the way as you're doing it today. But as they will be releasing them as they come out, it adds you the opportunity to do a change in the way you're doing it, not limiting you to the fact that it's coming in a whole bunch.
Yeah, people are still going to, you know, have their windows. It's just a matter of when the patch is available. So I think that it's really not going to make that much of a difference to the broad Windows space, especially the data center. Maybe the Windows PCs, they might be doing those updates a little bit more frequently, right? The default automatically install these updates type of option might be more in the face of the user, less updates, more frequent. But I think in the data center, it's going to be modus operandi.
Yeah. There was one point that I want to bring out that Chris was absolutely right about. I am someone that does the update when it comes in and even do it automatically. I don't even care about it. You can't really do that even on desktops for your employees, because a lot of the updates lately we've seen features disappear, right? And that's not something you can do in the working environment. So he was right about that. I can do that for my own devices. You can't really do that for your whole team. Right, so and there was another small thing coming back to something we talked about, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago when Microsoft announced the Nano server coming out in the next release, is that apparently, it's a small news fact, apparently Microsoft has already been running the Nano server or something similar, a very slimmed down Windows server for on Azure. And which is kind of surprising. I always thought they were running on the next Hyper-V version, right? Or an iteration, or like on server 2012, they were running 2012 R2, which is apparently not the fact. Azure has been running for a while now on that slimmed down Nano server. What comes out of that for me is that it's something that has been burned. They know what it is, and it's not going to be a new from the scratch and not well tested.
In order for them to go to market with something and that they can run ready from, you know, right now, they kind of have to have eaten their own dog food. And I think part of it is possibly hey, you know, we tried and we worked with this over a number of years, not just something we developed and pushed out. And we tweaked it and we've kind of validated internally as part of how Microsoft runs its organization. And if a company the size of Microsoft can leverage NanoServer for a bulk of their cloud-based workloads, then, you know, why can't you, Mr. Customer?
Yeah, so that was, for me, was that the trigger? I said, they haven't just been using it for internal IT, like you say, like you don't, no, they have been running it under Azure, which is something they sell, right?
Well, we got to be careful about that, and the devil's going to be in the details. I doubt that it's all of Azure, because early on, when Azure was launched, it was very clear that it runs the standard Server 2012 R2 Hyper-V role. So maybe a pocket of Azure, I'm not sure, but I doubt that it's all of Azure that's running NanoServer. I'm very interested in it also, but we got to be kind of scope cautious there, because Azure as a cloud is the number two cloud, and it's big, and that's a pretty bold statement, so we got to put it in the right box.
Yeah, you're right. Not the whole of Azure, but it has been running in public workloads. That was what has come out of that news. So let's move on to this week's tech news then, guys. First of all, Rickatron, we're waiting for you to bring your top three items from MS Ignite. We've got, after that, we have some security things, a VMware patch that has been reclaimed, a new major security breach called Venom, and then we have VMware released an end-user computing stuff at the same time that Citrix does it, and Nutanix releasing their community edition, which we talked about previously. So first of all, Rickatron, bring us your top three items for MS Ignite. What's your number three?
Azure in your own data center. Basically, out of Ignite, it's one of those things where you love the idea of full deployment models in a cloud, but you hate the cost, or you hate the lack of full infrastructure control. You know, this is a door opener, in my opinion, where basically the full Azure portal of give me a VM, give me a SQL Server, you can run that all on your own equipment in your own building. That is a pretty big deal. So there's a session that was dedicated to that. It's not out yet, but I believe it's coming. So that is a big deal. And we're talking a very, very similar experience to the public cloud brought home.
So not from a virtual machine manager perspective, not from a system centers type of management?
From a web page.
Okay.
Yeah, from a web page, from a portal, and an account and a portal, you can do things. I think that's a pretty big deal.
I've seen people, and I've worked in virtual machine manager and all the other system center stacks, and that has been one of my gripes at it, is that it is still a beast to handle, and a lot of work goes in there in education to work in that. The first time I started working on Azure, I think you even remember that we had that cloud edition at Veeam, and I wanted to test it out. We had a couple of public vendors we could connect to, and I wanted to make a video of it. So I went to Azure, never used it before. Within 15 minutes, I had VMs running, and I had a target to do my backups to, and it was all done. And I loved that simplicity that I had there in Azure. If that comes down to the regular admin without the need of a whole system center stack management, that is indeed a big deal.
I think so, because, you know, I actually hired a person on the staff that, you know, since you've left, you know, and she has no IT background. She's deployed more VMs in Azure than I, and it's very easy, because the portal, the experience there is not an infrastructure decision. It's like, okay, I need a database, I need a workload, I need et cetera. All those different like infrastructure things that we end up thinking about, like clusters, resource pool, data stores, those are all removed. And it is literally a good experience. To be able to bring that in, I think that's a big deal. So that was number three on my list.
Awesome. Number two,
Windows Server 2016, or Windows Server Next, or whatever you want to call it. It's kind of a blanket of a few things. The first of which is Nano, which we talked about as a kind of a low footprint. Nice touch, right? Not nice option. I'm not saying it's the end-all, be-all. but Windows Server 2016. And I'm actually, I had trouble finding the official note of this, but I think it was mentioned, but I cannot find it officially written. But I'll say it, nested Hyper-V is going to come. And that, my friends, is a big deal, especially when you can think about running that in Azure or, you know, lots of scenarios. Nested Hyper-V is a big deal that comes with kind of the full package of Server Next 2016, etc. So I'm very excited about that.
You know what? I'm not. Well, I am. From a technology perspective, I love it that you can do nested Hyper-V. We've been doing nested ESXi for a while on different platforms. We've got people doing it ghetto style, on small Apples. I have never seen someone making real use out of it in a production environment. So I love it from a technology, from a development perspective, from a lab perspective. How much is it really worth for a customer? Whether or not it's ESXi or it's nested Hyper-V, how much does that make sense in the field?
Well, for me, it's a big deal because that presumably, this is an entirely a speculation, it presumably means that Azure would be a public cloud where you can have full hypervisor access. Even and I hate to draw the comparisons, but in vCloud Air, you can't do that. They have a dedicated mode. It's not the same. It's not full hypervisor access. And I hate to draw those comparisons, but it's one of those natural conclusions that you have to do. But the fact is, I think this will be the first public cloud to provide through a transitive property of nested virtualization. It's really a groundbreaking moment. And, you know, you look at the two big players in data center like Hyper-V and VMware. Hyper-V has actually had a lot of firsts. This is something that'll win you a bet at a bar, right? Hyper-V had disk geometry bigger than 2 terabytes first. They had thin provisioning first. They had a lot of other firsts, right? But so does VMware. So these are like little, again, bar fights. But I'm excited about that only because, you know, I just think it's time that they've had it. I can appreciate, Hans, how you say it's not that big of a deal for nested virtualization. But when I think about the whole Windows Server 2016, Nano, nested, those, you know, that's really kind of exciting for me because I was honestly a little disappointed with Hyper-V from 2012 to 2012 R2. There's like zero new stuff. It was a really big improvement on 2012. Nothing serious from 2012 to 2012 R2. Now it's going to catch up with this one big feature that I've always wanted. So to me, that's a big deal.
You know, I mean, I look at it from the standpoint, for those companies or customers or people who develop software and need to test, a nested version of the hypervisor is definitely a lot more beneficial because it can significantly reduce your footprint internally. And then also be able to run it in Azure, obviously, reduces overhead and speeds time to market, speeds time to development. So anything that allows you to simulate a customer's environment virtually is definitely beneficial to those of us who craft solutions for people who consume software and services.
Or even a DR site, you know, then you can really fully craft up something in a public cloud. I mean, you really have a huge amount of options this way.
If you look at all of the tweaks and tools and things that people leverage nested VMware for, well outside of, you know, even the initial use cases and things that, you know, William Lamb had built and all the work that they've done, you know, a lot of people use it to do validation and home lab work and a lot of things outside the norm just because of the convenience of it, right, and the ability to simulate environments in such a way. So, I mean, I think it's another step forward for Microsoft in terms of getting to that, you know, that rich feature parity, you know, that VMware's kind of set the bar for. You know, from a business use case, I mean, it is somewhat limited. I don't think it's going to make the difference, yay or nay, whether somebody buys a Hyper-V or, an ESX. But it sure is nice to have, I think.
Okay, point taken. Rigatron, we've got still one to go. What is your number one from last week's convention?
You're going to hate me if you don't like it. You might not like it. The Surface. Oh. They have come out of nowhere and dropped in the Surface devices. They are for real, Hans. I have an old school RT1, and I almost wish I waited to buy this Surface 3 or the 3 Pro. I love this hardware, and I'll just say it this way. It's a real computer when you need it. I love it. I absolutely love this. I don't even know where my iPad is, by the way. Maybe it's here in my desk drawer. I don't know. Maybe it's lost. But I love these devices, and I got to see the Surface 3 for the first time, like touch and feel at Ignite. It is basically it replaces the RT, basically the ARM processor editions of Windows. That much more limited build is gone. So this is full Windows on a smaller tablet, a good form factor, good keyboard, proper USB port, and now you can even charge through micro USB. Everything about these things I love, and I think that to me is a really big deal. Not so much as another gadget, but the fact that they've come out of effectively nowhere and dropped in this hardware, and me now, that's really what I want. And
it's not effectively nowhere. It's the third version. They've been working for 2-3 years on it now. It's not coming from nowhere.
Well, 2 years.
Well, yeah, that's the point.
It's about two. But even the first one I had a year and a half ago, I liked, and I couldn't think I'd ever like it more. But I do. So, okay, maybe the nowhere was a little dramatic effect, but that's my number one. And I'm really happy with the Surfaces, and I really think what they're doing is pretty incredible, because it's a low margin business, it's a cutthroat business, and it was a big risk to their partners. I doubt they're still happy about it, but in fact, I saw, you know, the side note is that it's opened up a new market. So this is another reason why I like the Surface. It's opened up a new market. A new one I really want, an additional one, is called a HP Stream 7. It's a 7-inch full Windows tablet for $99. I saw one. I couldn't believe it. I literally am probably going to go buy one this week.
$99 is actually a pretty good deal. I would say, you know, for me, it looks this way. It's like Microsoft finally found their portable strategy that worked for them, right? I mean, after all the failed phone ventures and all of the, you know, the goofy solutions that had come out, the Zune and all of these weird little devices where they were in a consumables market, the Surface has been something that's been fairly successful for them. And most of the people I know who have a Surface love it. You know, I have an iPad. Really, it becomes the bathroom reader, because I just, you know, now that I'm on the 6 Plus, the phone, it's kind of replaced my tablet in terms of that bigger viewing screen solution that I use. So it's laptop and tablet now, phablet phone versus, laptop, tablet, and phone. I've never had hands-on with the Surface. I've seen plenty of them, and I'm sure I would like it. And I, as somebody who did just move back to a Wintel-based laptop after having a Mac for about a year, I probably should have investigated it, or at least looked at it a little more robustly with the new solutions that are coming out now. It does tend to get a little expensive once you start to add some of the add-ons to it, though. So that's just one thing that I've noticed, that it's not a cheap solution by any stretch of the imagination, but it very well, you know, I've seen, up in Microsoft campus when I was at the Millennium campus a couple months back, you know, a lot of the guys are using it as a full desktop replacement. So, you know, it's got the horsepower and the capabilities.
Doesn't everyone have that problem with products? Once you go over the default, you get the extras in cost?
Well, I mean, I don't know how many of those extras are, like, do I need to actually function, right? Yeah, I mean, when the iPad came out, there were so many, all right, I'm going to try and test this iPad for a week on the road and see if I can replace my laptop with it. And those tests ultimately failed just because there's just not enough utility in an iPad, right? But a Surface, for all intents and purposes, is a fully functional laptop computer, right, when you start to add some of those little bits and pieces to it.
Yeah, and it does get expensive, Gabe. That's a dirty secret, right? The base Surface 3 starts at $499, Surface 3 Pro $799. If you get the bigger storage, the keyboard, some extra gizmos, you could be well over $1,000. But I love what I've been seeing, and I'm real happy.
Okay, let's move on. Next up on our agenda is that VMware patch that has been reclaimed. We don't have to really discuss it in detail, but it's good for our listeners to know that, and this is the line, after upgrading to VMware ESXi 5.5 patch release, blah, 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 virtual machines using VMware NSX for vSphere 6 or Cisco Nexus 1000V are unable to communicate across hosts. So there has been a patch being deployed that could result in loss of communication. Patch has been pulled back. If you have it, so it's worth to look at it if you are in the case of running on NSX for vSphere 6.0 or Nexus 1000V, it may be worth looking if you have or have not downloaded that patch in the meantime.
You know, it's happened before with VMware and other vendors for that matter. Chances are, you know, the people that had the problem, you know, found that out. And I've worked with the VMware support people. They're very good at getting out of these situations. So, you know, that this doesn't tell me don't patch or don't update VMware.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You're right.
So this is an organic matter that happens. It becomes truly impossible to test everything, I'll be honest with you. So these types of case or corner case scenarios, you know, the 1% with VMware's customer base, even 0.1%, that's actually a pretty significant number. So, you know, for the listeners out there, this isn't anything to be concerned about. Just, you know, make sure you test things as good as you can before you yourself go into big changes. That's the takeaway.
What may be one to be concerned about, that was a big news today, is a new major security breach called Venom. And Venom is a floppy disk driver, actually a virtual floppy disk driver vulnerability that has been for ages in QEMU, Xen, and all KVM related hypervisors. What is actually happening is that a virtual floppy disk controller uses a fixed size buffer for storing the read, write, C commands, and all their parameters. After the command is executed, the buffer for that is cleared. Apparently, that is not the fact for at least two of the commands, and in there lies a vulnerability. If it's not cleared and you go over it, there could be a way of going from within the guest and bringing bad code into the hypervisor itself, into the host, or into other VMs that lie next to it. This is a big breach. I mean, if you would be a service provider that runs 1,000 KVM nodes and has multiple customers on it, you only need one of them to be breached to have access to everything underneath it. Now, that being said, it has been there all the time. I think it was since 2004. If I'm not mistaken, but there have not been any cases known of it. So it is a clear bug that has now been found and been publicized, but there are no breaches known. And everyone that has the issue, they would already have a patch for it. So if you're running something in public on QEMU, Xen, KVM-related hypervisors, well worth noting if you need the patch. It is not the case for ESXi, Hyper-V, and Box. Have you ever heard of Box Hypervisor?
No.
It's something PC hypervisor stuff. But yeah, you want to say, is this as big as Heartbleed or not?
And market share, no. But in terms of risk for the affected, yes, or maybe more.
It doesn't have a scope of Heartbleed in terms of all-encompassing across the entire ecosystem, but there are a lot of service providers and managed service providers at specific tier levels who are using Xen Hypervisor. And for them to have to go out and incur this kind of patch, is a challenge, right? Because it's downtime in certain instances.
Well, yeah, if you look at that one of them that has Apache is Rackspace. And I think Rackspace is running a pretty decent cloud out there.
Well, yeah. You know, and any time, you know, your cloud gets called into question over security concern, especially for something that looks as old as this one, it's always one of those little, it's like a death by a thousand cuts, right? You know, this little thing pops up and this other little thing pops up, and then you look at the people who are not affected, and it's, you know, it's a flood point that people can use against you. In the grand scheme of things, you know, I don't think this is nearly as tragic or as interruptive as some of the other security alerts that have caused pretty much every hardware and software vendor in the marketplace to go out there and change something. But, I mean, it's definitely something, it's a cause for concern, right, given the level and the full penetrability of the attack. And the fact that it's you know, it's something that's probably been out there for quite some time and just generally unaware of. But I would say that's probably the case for a lot of these exploits. I'm pretty sure the NSA has known about it, though.
Maybe that's how they did it. That's how they did it. They put it in there. They made sure that those two commands were not cleared in a buffer.
Hey, man, you found my back door. What are you doing to me, man?
Phrasing.
Phrasing.
We've got, and I don't have that much details on it because it's not my space, but apparently VMware and Citrix are now more and more fighting it on the same grounds as VMware is moving more into the end user computing space, where Citrix announced a workspace cloud is their name. VMware announced Enzo, yet another one of those names at VMware. I don't even know where they keep getting them. And both of them are not about really about desktop deployment, but including application deployment and so on. So I think VMware is really going head-to-head with Citrix on this one.
No comment. I mean, they've been trying to do end-user computing for a long time. They have great technology, don't get me wrong, but so does Citrix, and it's honestly not a huge market. So I myself, I'm just not interested in
it. I think app delivery today, if you think about phones, is a huge market.
Yeah, something like, I mean, isn't it something like 60% of Facebook usage comes from mobile now? I mean, they were so early to get in that space in terms of domination. And so if you want to look at the future of endpoint, application delivery, et cetera, and that's the space that I would want to kind of concentrate and focus on. I mean, the integration of the AirWatch technology and some of those other things also illustrate how quickly VMware can purchase something and turn around and get it integrated. For a lot of these products, it's been very, very fast. And that's got to, you know, you look at some companies, I mean, you look at, you know, especially in the storage arena where they've purchased something and it's been like 6 years later, they finally got it working and running or integrated. It's, you know, how long ago was the AirWatch purchase? A year or maybe less?
This is not Vue. This is not we'll bring you your desktop. No, this is we'll bring you your app to any single device you want out there. And this for me, this is huge. And VMware playing on that level is going to weigh in on the market. Especially because they are already inside the enterprise. There's maybe a lot of smaller players in the market, but next to Citrix, there's only VMware. Well, and maybe Microsoft, of course, that can play in that market in the enterprise.
But here's what I think is really important: the mobile part might insert VMware into use cases that the hypervisor might be irrelevant. So kind of like Citrix can. A lot of people run Citrix. The VDI solution on VMware, right? So the Citrix part doesn't go full stack. VMware might kind of go sideways. I have to watch it because I kind of think that in the end, I'm not really excited with it, but that's honestly because I've kind of moved myself. I mean, 10 years ago, I was working on literally the second largest smartphone deployment in the world. I was really romantically attached to that space, but you know, it's changed a lot. So I kind of turned off that part of my brain, and they might have a home run, but it just doesn't tickle the Rickatron. That's straight up.
How smart was your phone back then?
Oh, it was real smart. Yeah. Well, I mean, at the time it was BlackBerry, right? That's all we had. And we had a I don't know, 3,000 point of sale terminals on the phone, and I had it, you know, virtualized and spread across two data centers and stuff. It, for the time, it was very cutting edge. And I had like mobile, you know, assignments where I could find a tech and dispatch him to the closest job. And if I needed two people, I'd find the next closest person. And, you know, I could tell the managers how fast they're driving on the road. I mean, it was really advanced at the time, but it all went over smartphones, and it was device management that made that happen. So this, you know, for a certain line of business, the technology is absolutely a gateway to do what you want to do, but it might be easier nowadays with development of mobile apps. And, you know, bring your own device is a big threat to this type of this end of that end user computing experience. But like I said, I've kind of checked out of that because I'm tired of the flame wars. I'm tired of the iOS versus Android versus BlackBerry versus Windows Phone, whatever. So I kind of check out.
What year was that? No, I was just curious. What year was that, Rick? Was it 2005, 2006?
I started in 2007. 2007 I started with it. It's the first thing I had to do. It was great at the time. Here's a funny joke. So we had, like I said, thousands of users on this system, and they all had their phones. And literally, I remember hearing a phone call, Jose, you cannot drive 90 miles an hour on the road. And then I remember when they had all the data, there was this weird kind of cluster on the map. And, you know, this is a private podcast, so I can kind of share this. But basically, it was a Wednesday before the U.S. holiday of Thanksgiving. And that's honestly kind of where it was the afternoon. The work kind of tapers off, right? Basically, all the texts were clustered in one spot. And so we're like, click, 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 zoom in, zoom in, zoom in. Where were they? They were all at a strip club by the airport. So we had way too much data, okay? we knew what was going on, and it's like, this has got to stop.
Could you live download their pictures they were taking?
Negative.
Oh, yeah. we had that. we had a person whose job it was to be the email filter. So all of – you know, there was a – I can't remember if it was Tumbleweed or what it was that would scan every image that our – because we were a big BlackBerry shop too. We had like 800 to 900 field technicians at Toshiba where we ran everything that they did from our order processing to parts delivery for all these medical devices in the field. You know, I had 44 Lotus Notes servers and probably 20 BlackBerry servers running at one point in time, right? To facilitate and leverage all the apps that we were doing on there. It was very mobile. You know, even our director of IT was on the cover of like BlackBerry magazine because of what they were doing. But I remember one of the mail admins, his job was to check the filter for images that got caught and intercepted. It was based off of color pattern recognition. So suffice to say, there were always some interesting stories about people who worked together. And the things that they would send each other.
Oh, please. I don't even want to know. Let's not go there. Hey, final point on this week's tech news is Nutanix has now released, quote-unquote, their community edition. With released, I mean it's now a public beta. You're going to have to sign up for, and they're going to release it in batches as it sometimes goes. There were a couple of blog posts out from some of the private beta bloggers.
Yeah, Joe had a nice post. There was a couple of good, really, really good posts and interesting takes on it.
Upiscar did one. I think Andrea Mauro did one. So there were a couple of good blog posts on it. The biggest takeaway that I had from it is that you will really need to want to test it out because it will require dedicated hardware. It's an installer, but the installer will require and will check for some things to be there, like VTD, so like the virtualization things from your CPU. So it will require physical hardware from you. It's not something you can just test next to all your other stuff in your lab. I think it's something that will limit the use of it. But I think there was no other way for them to do it than that.
So, but yeah, I think part of the challenge there, though, is that legitimately a community edition solution, right? If I need to have four physical hosts of a certain type, and it's not like a, you know, it's not like most of us, you know, a lot of people have home labs, but you've seen this kind of this migration towards the smallest home labs possible, right? You see a lot of Mac minis, you see a lot of these solutions out there that are trying to strip down because, you know, it's tough on the home user to spin up four physical servers and all the stuff that goes along with them. But the reality is like if you look at the spec for that, it's not a light spec. It's a legitimate, you know, you're probably gonna have to go out and pick up 4 1U servers or something like that. So to me, there's limited utility if I can't nest that solution at home on my small 2-node home lab or whatever it is. I see it more geared towards their customers who will have possibly gear laying around that they can leverage, right? But keep in mind, it all has to be a certain type of SSD. It all has to be a certain type of controller. So for me, that's, you know, it really is a solution that their customers are going to want to look to leverage and try out versus the actual community. And in that respect, you know, what does an event like this cause? It causes a lot of people to go sign up for something, and those are a lot of people you can call to see what their further interest is, right? So, you know, as a sleight of hand secondary effect, it's a lead generation event, as well as, you know, a lot of buzz and a lot of positive press and a lot of interest.
Yeah, isn't it always?
Hey, you don't sell anything unless you get the Glengarry leads. But no, in reality, you know, it's all about driving business and driving value, and that's a legitimate use in my view. I don't see it as a nefarious or sleight of hand or anything of that nature. It's just it's the way we get to find out who is interested in our product and in turn sell it to them. Yep.
So it will be a little bit harder for you if you thought, well, let me try out this community edition. It will be a little bit harder than expected. It's there are not a lot of other ways around it. I may have hoped that it would have been a little bit more open.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were expecting that it was going to be software they could download and play with.
Yes.
Right? But the reality is that solution requires 3 nodes regardless, right? So it's either going to be, you know, 3 nested nodes and or it's going to be 3 physical systems, right? And I think in order, you know, I always look back to hyperconverged is controlling the experience for the customer, and that's why everybody went to market with a hardware solution tied to software. Mm-hmm. Because in reality, you know, you pick a platform and for supportability and for you know, consistency of experience and consistency of performance, you leverage this piece of hardware or these platforms to go to market with. And that's why I've never thought of software-defined X as going to have the same penetration rate as a, you know, an appliance-based solution that's going to do some of those things. That's probably why, you know, companies like Maxa and a few of the others haven't got quite the penetration or visibility in what we would traditionally call hyper-converged infrastructure,
right?
Even though they've kind of attached themselves to that market.
Yep, definitely. Well, I just think back on when I was working as a reseller consultant, what I did with those installers, I had no issues making them small. I worked with the HP left-hand VSAs. Remember, we made them really small, and we put 3 or 4 of them on one host. The only reason we did that was to look at the user interface, making screenshots, making demos, and that's all things you will not be able to do with this one unless you buy the whole kit necessary to do it. So it will definitely limit the use of it. For someone else that is used to doing a lot of stuff in the lab, it will be indeed more into, I want to build my own POC, for example. Okay, wrapping it up this week, there's one small business news item. I didn't pick up a lot more, just this one, is that Nebula, remember the company that that closed their books, to say it properly, a couple of weeks back, apparently 90% of their engineers have already been picked up by none else than Oracle. So good for the engineers that, because it was a good venture. There's a lot of smart people in there. They were early to the market to bring an OpenStack appliance, too early to the market. But at least they've been picked up as a group, which is also a good thing. Maybe they can move on and work on that whole idea further on in Oracle?
I mean, I think what Oracle did was, you know, is what Oracle does best is get things, get talented people in at a reduced price point. You know, for them to buy Nebula would have been a much higher target price point to bring it in than to wait for it to fold, if that's what they were indeed looking to do. Not that I think they have any special crystal ball, but you know, to bring people in.
That's a very fair point. Oracle tends to pick up lost ships.
Right, and then and in turn, turn around and repair them and bring them into the fold, or at least bring some of the pieces in the fold. I mean, you know, they did the same thing. There's somewhat of a pattern, right? So, you know, you have Sun, which is the big one. You have something like a Green Bytes, which they picked up, and we still don't know quite what they're going to do with them yet. But that was another startup that had some interesting technology around ZFS and deduplication that they picked up on after the company essentially floundered in the marketplace. As an appliance that didn't work, and then as a software solution that they couldn't sell. So got that one on the cheap. And then, you know, if you want to go into the OpenStack space, then, you know, you have some of the best talented engineers in the hardware OpenStack appliance model in Nebula. Well, great. Now you just picked all of them up, part and parcel. You know, there are companies out there who focus and buy talent instead of IP.
Yes.
You know.
And you know what? I'm actually just happy for the engineers that in that short term, the whole team got something new to work on and not just being spread around one here, one there. I like the idea that the whole team together got acquired or at least hired now instead of acquired by Oracle. And with that, we're going to wrap up the show. Anything in specific? We actually, for the listeners, you haven't heard him for a couple of minutes because Rickatron left the call a couple of minutes ago. Gabriel, what's your plan for the next weeks until our next recording?
I'm actually going to be at OpenStack Summit. I'm flying to Vancouver on
Sunday. Oh, is that next week?
I'll be there the whole week with SolidFire and the team.
Okay, and with that, it's a wrapper for this week. Hear you all back next week, same time, same place.